Well, thanks for choosing GoldSeek.com Radio as a trusted business and investing information source. Today's featured guest, Bob Hoy from Institutional Advisors. Editor-in-Chief, Investment Strategist of Institutional Advisors, Mr. Bob Hoy, way up in the lovely scenic Vancouver in Canada. Welcome back, Bob.
Good to be with you, Chris, and your listeners, too. And we're looking at a world of financial violence out there. And I've often said that the private sector, like individuals and companies and executives, can all get speculative on their own. That's without central bank, and we're going way back in history, a couple hundred years ago. So, but what you have here, and what is really affecting the volatility, is that you've got a bunch of financial schemers have got a hold of various government agencies, like the bank, the Federal Reserve, for example, and the theory that they can manage the economy is itself highly speculative, and then that they have become so aggressive, relentlessly aggressive and reckless with it, adds on a level of speculation unseen. So you've got a combination of a public that can at times become highly speculative, and any of those great speculations, of course, they burn out and fail. But you've now had it added to by one, a speculative notion about a central bank, and then the operators of that central bank becoming highly speculative themselves. So it's a crazy world. And I think if you have the right sort of technical tools, you can more or less stay on top of it and make the best of a very weird world. And, of course, our interest it has been in, you know, underneath it all. Well, we do credit spreads, the yield curve, moves in bond prices and commodities and currencies and stocks and bonds and all that sort of stuff. But our favorite side is the gold side, mainly because it offers, you know, an impartial adjudication on modern policymaking. But it also has things that it does on its own. And just to back up on the gold side, in 2011 marked the end of more than 10-year bull market in gold's dollar price and in the gold stock, certainly. And that length of run ended with a combination of huge confidence where some of the seniors got into political regions where they shouldn't consider trying to open a mine, and some of them had difficulty in geology and that sort of stuff. So, but as exciting as all that was, there was an indicator that gave us the sell, and that is the silver-gold ratio. Then you put a momentum on it called the RSI,
right.
And in any bull market for precious metals, silver will outperform gold. So, and then it'll, as you get to the culmination of it, it really outperforms. So the daily RSI on that move in 2011 got up to 92. So we'd known the history of it. And the only other time the RSI and the silver-gold ratio got up to 92 was in January of 1980, which was that huge peak.
You know, Bob, it's a great observation, and if I might just interject here briefly for a moment. You know, it's kind of ironic that they call it the relative strength index, because when you talk about, you throw these numbers out here, don't you think we need to qualify and let the listeners know that it really is relative? For instance, just because you have a higher peak doesn't necessarily mean that it might not run for another year or two. You might think of it as a tool in your arsenal, but you certainly wouldn't use it in isolation, would you?
No, because what we also used, and this was, I don't know, I think late 80s when I noticed it, was that in when you started getting more data available, but in January 1980, in that huge blowout, The key to it is that silver began to underperform gold 2 or 3 weeks before the top. So then there was two items then. If we couldn't put a momentum on gold in that speculation, because we just didn't have the tools for it. I wasn't even doing institutional stuff until 1982. But at any rate, looking back on it. So there's the two things. It's the silver bull that really does provide the energy on the rally enough to drive the RSI up. And then what you look for is when the silver begins to underperform gold, and then 2 or 3 weeks later, you'll have top for both prices. So at any rate, since then, in 2011, when we got that signal, we noted that this added speculation was at a dangerous level and that the decline may not be as bad as what followed 1980, but it would be unpleasant. So then you had the first hit, and then September, and then in September 2013, it was the next rally up. And that one, I know I was at a conference in Carlsbad, California, September the 8th or something like that, and then the RSI was up to 84 on the silver-gold ratio, which anything above 78 is dangerous, and mentioned that. So then, and then that has provided excellent outs for us, and we've tried any number of technical tools to get the lows and the bounces. So we've had some trades, and last November I did one on what we would need to re-enter the market, which was to see the silver beginning to outperform gold, and you also would want to see the gold stocks beginning to outperform the bullion price, and that we got. So then the first rally out of, let's say, Christmas was fast and quick and got overbought again. And then the final sort of was a weak sell in May on that silver-gold ratio. I think it got to 76, but we figured, hey, this is a tired market. And so that was our last advice to take some money off the table in the sector. So now, going back now 5 weeks ago, the troops kind of got excited about a commitment to traders number, and my colleague, who is very good on these things, said, no, not yet. And now we have often a seasonal low for the precious metal sector, gold particularly, in early August, or into September. So, and then we have pretty well exhausted sector. I mean, it is very painful out there, and every time I look at my portfolio, I look at millions of juniors that, I mean, you can't sell them all, even though you want to sell. We're looking at an intermediate rally for gold out of where we are now. Maybe the low was last week. Who knows? It'll need to be tested. But on the gold shares, there could be still some risk in here because the U.S., the big NYSE is topping as we speak. The advanced declines on the New York Stock Exchange have been a disaster since June. You've had margin debt peak also. No, that was May, I think. So those advanced declines, when you get a peak in those things, the trend up can continue in the senior indexes for a few months, let's put it that way. So, but that few months from May, June is now running out, and we're running out at a time when, if there's anything going to go wrong, it'll likely be discovered in the fall. And on that part, Chris, we, of course, watch the credit spreads, the difference between high yield or high grade bonds and lower grade stuff like junk. So we found that one, if you go into May or June with enthusiasm, with spreads narrowing, and it's been a financial party, well, then there's a seasonal reversal in June, you know, in or around June, which we're getting. Now, we used this in real time in 1998 when the big deal was the European community coming together, and that all interest rates in Europe would narrow. And they called it the convergence, and long-term capital markets was the big player there, highly leveraged, $4.5 billion fund. And they assumed that the government in Europe could keep the narrowing of spreads. We assumed that the seasonal would work and it would reverse in June, and it did. And then you had that horrendous disaster. So those credit spreads worked for us then. Also in 2000, but it was more or less instantaneous on that bubble. Then again in 2007, the spread started to reverse and change in June, signaling, and I remember I was at an institutional seminar thing in London at that time, and we had a slide on the presentation of a tremendous train wreck, and the quote was that the greatest train wreck in the history of credit had started. That was 2007. So then the stock market peaked that October and had a good hit into the spring. Then the next rally up, then again the same thing happened where the credit spreads narrowed on enthusiasm and reversed in June. So this thing is so remarkable that we're running 1998, 2007, 2008, and now. So on the reversal, you'd want to have like the first step to breaking out on widening in early July, and we got that. Then the next and more severe breakout of widening would be likely at late July or early August, and the yield on this one was, the spread on this one was 208 basis points on yesterday's posting. And at its maximum in January, under the panic of crude oil and junk bonds and all that sort of stuff, it was 212 basis points. So, hey, we're almost breaking out in early August. So as far as spreads go, we're very similar to the action in 1998, which led to the collapse of LTCM, 2007, which led to the greatest credit contraction since the 1930s, and then 2008, that's preceded that when it became a real crash. So the warning signs are out there, Chris.
So when you talk about these warning signs, are we really paying attention, though, to the prevailing trend? We have seen this forceful trend in place for a number of years. And, you know, the number of naysayers and top callers that have been left by the side of the road for many, many years continues to stack up. What are some of the fundamentals that you think could be driving this technical sea change ahead? For instance, are we witnessing an adjustment to the expected Federal Reserve rate hike in September and December of this year?
Those guys, they haven't got a clue. You know, it was only a couple of weeks ago when I thought, now what have they been talking about for the last year about raising the administered rate? Not happening. My thought on this one, Chris, is that they started talking about it because the Fed had become so reckless. So then if they talked about raising rates, it gave them a little more credibility. Mm-hmm. But I think the reason why the rate hasn't gone up is because the party's still on. They can't raise the administered rate. Now, to go back to the bubbles, the great bubbles in history, 1929, 1873, and then using the Bank of England, which was the senior, well, London was the senior market, and the Bank of England was the senior central bank. Now, in each of those, you had interest rates going up with the boom and then down with the bust. And in each case, the record of the central bank is that they were 3 or 4 months behind the change in market rates of interest. So I expect that this time around on this bubble, that they will be behind any change of interest rates that happens in the marketplace. So all these people who focus on what the Fed's going to do about interest rates are watching the wrong gate. It's not going to happen. As a matter of fact, I think in the next contraction, you know, bond prices going down, further weakness in commodities, an economic contraction, banking pressures, the whole thing. What you want to look at is the market rates of interest, like T-bill rates or commercial paper, or more particularly longer rates. That's where the action is going to be. And the past great bubbles.
The only reason I ask is that regardless of our personal and professional opinion of the institution, I mean, when they change rates, it really dramatically impacts the market.
The dramatic changes in interest rates. It's Mother Nature that does it.
I do concur with you that they have to adjust along with the prevailing themes, because it's an enormous market. I understand that. But I think you would at least agree, at least at some level. I mean, look at a number of hedge funds that run arbitrage plays as a result of each Fed announcement.
Oh, yeah, there's that action. But if you look at over the bigger picture, they follow. Let's put it this way. I think the next contraction will happen. It, according to interest, the credit spreads now, just a little further widening triggers off, you know, continue the trend of towards the next contraction. Okay, then it'll be seen that the Feds have used huge amounts of taxpayer money to bolster their theory that they can manage the economy. So you're going to get a contraction. And the folks are going to say, so this one is where they lose a lot of credibility. I think eventually the public will force them to go back to a gold standard. It's the only way you can constrain an ambitious government.
Well, that's an interesting topic. I'm glad you brought up the gold standard because, you know, over the holiday, you know, I had a chance to talk with some very well-connected folks in my family who work in the heart of London, found myself defending the whole concept of the gold standard, because the common theme that I heard was, in the most polite terms, there's just too much money out there. And, you know, Adam Smith is from your homeland, and he made it very clear a couple hundred years ago that the market forces dictate the true price over time, that regardless of the amount of manipulation by officials and governments, eventually the true market price will be reestablished. So it really doesn't matter how much paper fiat money is floating around the world. You actually are making the case for a very high precious metals price.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. But I could look at it this way, and that is that the intellectuals got rid of the gold standard so that they could manage the economy. Now, then the next step to that is that bureaucrats discovered they could build endless empires.
Yeah, they picked up the reins.
Because the central bank would then provide unlimited funds for another experiment in unlimited government. But the whole purpose of a gold standard is to manage the ambition of government. And the public will bring it back on. I mean, the experiment in hands-on management of the economy has always been utopian, a dream, a scheme by financial adventurers, and it's run for a little more than 100 years, and there was only two other experiments in authoritarian government in the senior economy that went out of control. The first one was the 3rd century in Rome, when they turned Rome into a police state, and it collapsed.
You might recall the researcher who did considerable work in this area, and he came to the startling conclusion that, in general, democracies last around 200 years. That is, they last until the time that the people realize they can vote into power the folks who will give them the kickbacks, the monthly paychecks. And here we find ourselves over 200 years into this experiment.
Yeah, that quote is tighter than that. Democracy works until you give somebody the vote. Somebody will then use the legislative process to vote themselves somebody else's money. But the two examples previous, where you had the senior economy turn absolutely authoritarian, the second example was in the 1500s, and that went until the early 1600s. This is my case, is that each of those ran for 100 years and ended when the authoritarians had absorbed or confiscated all of the wealth, and then it ends because the economy doesn't work anymore. The public rediscovers its common sense and looks at the nonsense and says, hey, this is ending. So this is where I think we're at.
I'd like to share a derivative of that original quote by Alexis de Tocqueville, thanks to GoogleSearch.com. Here we are. The American Republic will endure until the day that its Congress discovers it can bribe the public with the public's money.
There it is. Yeah. But eventually that doesn't work because they ruin the pricing mechanism for determining the allocation of goods and service, the allocation of credit. They ruin it and it collapses. So, but the main thing, it's a belief system. Like the old saying on the Vancouver Stock Exchange is that on a rising stock, so long as the stock is going up, the public will believe the most absurd story. And then it breaks, and all of a sudden you realize, hey, that's an absurd story. So on this one, it's the credit expansion. So so long as the central banks can keep credit expanding, the public will believe that they're in charge and running things. But it's now gone so far. And then through 300 years of central bank history, there's no evidence that they can prevent a bubble from happening. There's no evidence they can prevent a bubble from blowing out and collapsing. And I think the collapse of this one will really do it to the image of central bankers. So it's going to be... Chris, you and I are privileged, and the listeners that we have, to be participating in financial history right now, because this is record stuff. And it'll be an absolutely fantastic change on the next contraction. And as I say, the one of the measures on that is the widening of credit spreads. And in a week or so, we'll know where we are on that one.
How are we privileged? I mean, are we privileged to be in the
participants? You and I being around 40 years and reading it in the history books or reading it in journals or in the newspapers of the day, we're actual participants in one of the most absurd experiments in government ever carried off.
But when this starts to unravel at the seams, and we're already seeing some of the seams unravel, other than the typical, let's have 15-20% precious metals in our portfolios.
You don't want to be carrying any debt with asset prices on the next decline. And that asset prices would include house prices and stuff like that. And the only way, the best way to protect yourself from that is not to have any debt. But consider gold as an insurance, you know, where currencies have been weak in other countries, gold has worked. The only confusion in existing there for gold bugs is that the U.S. dollar has been strong. But I always point out that in every post-bubble period, the senior currency becomes chronically strong against most commodities and against most currencies for most of the time. And this is what's happening.
Before we move on to the South American financial implosion that I don't think is getting quite enough press today, and I'm worried about that becoming systemic, since we brought up this topic and then we'll close down the issue with a final quote, thanks again to Google Search, from Alexander Tyler. He was a Scottish history professor in 1787. The moment you hear this, most of our listeners will recognize the quote.
Oh, yeah.
A democracy is always temporary in nature. It simply cannot exist as a permanent form of government. The democracy will continue to exist up until the time that voters discover, and here it comes, right, that they can vote themselves generous gifts from the public treasury. From that moment forward, the majority always votes for the candidates who promise the most benefits from the public treasury, with the result that every democracy will finally collapse due to loose fiscal policy, which is always followed by a dictatorship. Because this is so apropos. The average age of the world's greatest civilizations from the beginning of history has been about 200 years. During those two centuries, these nations always progress through this sequence: bondage to spiritual faith to great courage, courage to liberty, liberty to abundance, abundance to complacency, complacency to apathy, apathy to dependence, and dependence back to bondage.
Oh, yeah. Now, at the moment, the state is supreme. It's intruding in a manner that it hasn't been seen since the early 1600s, and it's intruding in a manner unseen since the early 400s. And in each of those cases, the public threw off the monsters. So the recipe as described by that researcher is not quite in accord with what I've seen in financial history. So this is where, now, for example, her name, Barbara Gray, I think it was a historian of ancient Egypt. Okay, so you had the expansion of the floods and the greater prosperity and the greater the population, and then you'd go into a point where the floods would not be so good. That's the way the world works. So then you would have hardship, and then you had in the capital of Egypt, in each of those dynastic changes, the apparatus of government had all the grain and were living well when the ordinary public was not living well. So here you had and then the palace guards with the spears were of the public. They were not of the aristocracy. So at some point, the public gets pissed off. Palace guards lay down their spears, and you have an interregnum, and they grab the grain that the city-state was storing. Okay, now, that one I read back in the mid-70s, and then when you then came to the late 1980s in Eastern Europe, where then the public looked at the promises from the governing classes, looked at how well they were living, and looked at the bad deal they were getting, and they took on, in 1989, when the Berlin Wall came down, they took on a murderous police state. So the break on there was not perestroika or any of those other terms they were using in Russia. It was that the border guards with the Kalashnikovs, one day they said, they looked at East Germans wanting to go cross-border shopping in Hungary or West Germany, and they said, what are we doing here? So they laid down their weapons. So it was the same thing as happened in ancient Egypt. And in the Western world now, England, United States, Canada, the statists, all they have is propaganda. They will not use the tanks or the Kalashnikovs against their own people in those three countries I mentioned. So on the next contraction, the belief that the state can provide all will fail. And imagine what those people in, let's say, Russia or East Germany that were on state pensions and the state collapsed. Okay, now, in your country, any of the democratic cities, of course, and not just in current terms, but also with never-ending pension benefits. So there's any number of cities and counties that are facing bankruptcy, and it'll happen. So we're going into a very exciting period. The authoritarian side in England and United States and Canada has been fully expressed, and in particular right now with Obama out to manage the global, not just the economy, but also the global climate, is the height of audacity, and all of this stuff's going to be crashing down. So no, the dictatorship is on now. The public will throw it off when the dictatorship is seen not to be working, and one of the signs of it seen not to be working will be the next financial and economic contraction. Game over. I'm very excited about it.
I know that you have an interest, as many of our listeners, in the intelligence agencies. And, you know, there's been so much talk about Alan Turing, his great contribution to not only computers. I mean, he arguably created the modern design, if you will, for the computer, and then created the Bamba. And I think he also helped with the giant first computer in Britain. But you know, there are two unsung heroes that cracked not the Enigma, which was the everyday submarine U-boat device for communication with their leaders and whatnot. But there was another two unsung heroes named Tut and Flowers cracked the big Enigma. And I don't think that they get a lot of recognition because it was so top secret. It was unknown for quite some time. Up until just recent years, no one was allowed. It was top secret. I think it's a shame that people like this, who contributed so much to the welfare and freedoms that we enjoy today, are shrouded in such mystery. It's doing a disservice to the folks who really do the heavy lifting, if you will.
Well, I'm not familiar with the two people you're referring to, but certainly as beginning of the 1970s when, Masterson wrote the double cross system and things like that, it's about British intelligence. But I've read a lot about of intelligence, and it's very difficult to determine what is real and what is not real because there was so much duplicity. And as Churchill said, that times of war, the truth is so precious that she must be protected by a bodyguard of lies. So certainly in the development of the computer in the Second World War, and those involved with it are due every credit they're due, but I'm not, you know, to get into that gets pretty woolly, and I quit reading this stuff a long time ago.
There were several groups working at the same time. For instance, in the United States on the East Coast, a group working on the Japanese code, and that was particularly difficult to crack, and they actually had a tremendous impact. And once that code was broken, again, the war in the Pacific, which, as we know, started out very poorly, the tide really shifted.
And then also there was the, for a while, I think in Europe, the American forces were using a code based upon one of the native Indian languages. And I can't remember whether that was Navajo or what, but anyway.
The Navajo language was the basis. They were called the Wind Talkers. There was actually a movie with Nicolas Cage you may have seen. And one of the reasons why they chose Navajo language, it was highly isolated. There was very little literature regarding the language. They could contain it. You just couldn't crack it.
If it has a price history, then there is highly likely to be, if it's a long enough history, replication. And this is the blow-off in the Shanghai Index. It's quite like 1929. It's quite like gold in 1980. It's quite like the NASDAQ in 2000. And and even the first crack in the SSEC, the China Shanghai Index, we had a target, the 200-day moving average. Boom, it hit there. Then the rebound was up to something like 4,100, completed by July 24th. That was a Friday. It hit that, then the next low. So the pattern of a blowout, a huge financial blowout, doesn't matter whether it's in the Nikkei in 1989, stocks in 1929, gold in 1980, it is all the same, huge blow. So the China market completed the bubble. It's working on a complete failure, and the path, it's on path for a complete failure. And when you have an outlying exchange like Shanghai do a bubble and fail, it eventually feeds into the senior financial markets.
PEK, ETF for the Shanghai Index. It's a good proxy for overall Chinese stocks. And you can get an idea. You can just see this massive 25 to 30 plus percent drop. Prices stabilized a bit, but you know, they look weak again.
They showed that they're extremely naive and tried everything to prevent, you know, halted trading in certain stocks, halted big accounts from trading, put billions of dollars in to support it, and it didn't work. But at any rate, I'll leave you with another historical one on this very problem, where when you've had a blowout in an outlying exchange coming back into the senior market, and that was back in Roman times when the writer Cicero observed that when there was a problem in the eastern part of the empire, like in Phoenicia, which point of trade, if there was a financial problem there, it would feed into Rome itself, which was the case. The moving figure has writ, and it has written that the Shanghai market has blown out, and it is collapsing in a path similar to previous such collapses. Inevitable that it'll get the senior financial markets in London and in New York.
It would be apropos to wrap up the show with another quote from Cicero. Life is nothing without friendship. We appreciate your time. Please tell people more about the services you provide.
You can get into our website, institutionaladvisors.com, or actually just Google the name, Bob Hoy, and you get into our system. We'll put interested parties on the free introduction for 4 or 5 weeks. If you like the product, there's a negotiated fee. Good to be with you, Chris. Good to talk.